Questions? Questions, questions, questions? So I have one checkout for the detailed question. You remember that that's a course requirement. You have to ask a detailed question at some point.
We all do that, don't we?
Not yet, only one person. So typically questions about homework aren't detailed questions.
You didn't know that.
Yeah.
I thought that was detailed enough.
Yeah, I changed the rules on you.
We can't do that.
I do it all the time.
Yeah, we know. So what are the criteria then?
Whatever I decide. If you think you deserve it, you should say, I deserve this, and I will maybe check it off or not. But it shouldn't be a question like, how do I do the homework questions? But it might be related to a homework question. Okay, so we were talking last time about Fourier's trick, and Fourier's trick is really not so tricky, right? So if we have a vector like in 191, which is a combination of stuff in the I, j, and k direction, if we dot that vector with the k unit vector, what we're going to get is just the z component, right? Because these guys are orthogonal, so when we dot them, we're going to get zero. So what's new and tricky is I'm not going to limit myself to just three coordinates or just 103 coordinates or just a Google and three coordinates. I want lots of coordinates. So instead of having an index that goes 1, 2, 3, I'm going to have an index that is all real numbers. There are a lot of coordinates there. So I can talk about the coordinate in the pi direction and the 2 direction and in the other direction. And this dot product then, it's going to be a sum over all of those coordinates, so it's going to go over to an integral. And this dot product of k with k then is going to go over with that integral squared. Now, for unit vectors, this thing was always 1, but not uncommonly in this enlarged space, this thing won't be 1, so I won't set this equal to 1 immediately, although you could do that if you really wanted to. Okay, so this then is a formula that allows me to calculate the expansion coefficient, a sub I, as long as I know what these unit vectors are and what the original function is. Say again? Yeah, so we could make them all equal to 1, but typically people don't bother to do that. You remember that these pn's, for example, instead of integrating out to 1, it's 2 over 2n plus 1. So we could put 1 over the square root of that on the other side of the equation and divide and define something that was a unit vector, but it just makes things messier. So our unit functions are typically not going to be unit functions. They're going to be orthogonal, but not normal. It's like the second meaning of normal. Okay, so we're interested in solving problems of the nature of you tell me what the voltage is on the boundary, and I tell you what the voltage is every place in space. We already solved problems of the nature you tell me the charge distribution, and I tell you where the voltage is every place in space. But it turns out that people typically can control voltages more than charge. The charge moves wherever it wants to on a conductor, so it's a little bit harder to control. So with that in mind, we took a look at solving Laplace's equation, which is what the voltage has to satisfy in the absence of charge, so in free space. And we looked at this particular problem where we had a gutter where the voltage was zero on three sides and it was non-zero on the open side, but we knew what the voltage was on the open side. So by separating variables, we found out that this was a possible solution to Laplace's equation. And so I claim that I can describe any possible voltage by a linear combination of these basic solutions. All I need to do is define these expansion coefficients. And that was made easy because the sines are orthogonal functions. That is to say, if I integrate the sine of pi m divided by b times y times the sine of pi n divided by b times y, I'm going to get zero unless n is equal to m.
So is this literally what Fourier class is about, right? I mean, that's what we're working on right now. Is
yeah, so
stuff like making up
yeah,
a n's and a naughts and b naughts.
Yeah, you should do more than just that too.
Oh, thanks. So it's gonna be
It's not all, you're not all done yet. Maybe you're going to prove some of these things too.
No.
you'll take them on blind faith. Okay, so here is the dot product of A and my unit vector. And it turns out that the norm of these vectors is B over 2. So here's the corresponding formula for A. And once I know what those A's are, I can add them up like with Mathematica. Probably don't want to do all infinity of them, but I can maybe do the first 20 of them and get a reasonable representation for what phi is. If I want it more accurate, I just take more of them. Okay, yes?
How do you get that norm is 1 half phi?
So it's just a simple integral of sine times sine. So in some sense, it's just an elementary property from your first course in calculus. But how I remember to do it is with the following trick. That is to say that the average value of sine squared is a half. Right? So sometimes sine is 0, sometimes it's 1, sometimes it's minus 1. But it kind of makes sense that the average value of sine squared is a half. So if I have an integral from, say, 0 to b of sine squared, what I'm going to write then is immediately that the average value of sine is a half and the range of integration is b.
Oh, that's right. Normal means mean length, right?
Say again?
I forgot that normal means mean length now, right? Isn't normal something different than
yeah. So normal continues to mean perpendicular sometimes. But it also means that the dot product of two vectors is 1.
Okay.
So here, this is a not, these vectors, the sine functions, are orthogonal, but they're not normal.
Okay.
Now, unhappy nomenclature.
Okay, so it can be, so two things can be orthogonal, but it doesn't mean that they're normal.
It's because of the two different meanings of normal. Right? So normal can mean exactly the same thing as perpendicular.
You know what you're doing.
Ooh. Wow. Normal means exactly the same thing as perpendicular. But for us, it's also going to mean that, I'll write it in terms of vectors, that v1 dot w is 1. So how it is that the same word came to mean exactly opposite things, right? Because here, v dot w would be equal to 0. How it came about that the same word means exactly opposite things, I don't know. Yeah, but that's the way it is. Okay. So we were working through our way through that handout, and what we have shown by separation of variables that in spherical coordinates, the most general solution is something like this. And when you look at this, you should kind of automatically and immediately be thinking, if the region I care about includes the origin, I can't have a term like this. Typically, we have terms like this when we're outside of the origin. And similarly, if we have a region that includes infinity, we can't have a term like this because the voltage can't be infinity at infinity. So typically we have terms like this when we're inside something. Typically we have terms like this when we're outside something. And in particular for the first example we worked, that was exactly the case, right? We were looking at the voltage inside of a sphere where the voltage was specified on the boundary, and we only had terms like this. Okay, so the second example dealt with what happens if instead of the voltage being specified, the charge density is specified? And we already know how to solve those problems by integration, but here's maybe a different way, often a more efficient way of doing it. So what we're going to have then is the same sort of solutions. So the particular problem we're dealing with is we're interested in the voltage every place in space where the charge density on a surface of a sphere has been specified. And of course, all of the problems we're working are azimuthally symmetric, so the charge density just depends on latitude, as it were, theta, as opposed to longitude. So by the usual argument, inside the sphere, we don't have any C terms, and outside the sphere, we don't have any A terms. Now, there is only A value for voltage at any particular spot. So on the surface of the sphere, this formula and this formula have to agree. So if we write down what it means for those two to agree, that means when I plug in R to get this coefficient and I plug in R to get that same coefficient, I have to get the same coefficient. So this is one equation and an infinite number of unknowns. So it's maybe a start. Can we get even more equations so we can in the end solve this? And what we said is we could kind of think about Gauss's law. So we can calculate what the electric field is just outside of this charge density, and we could calculate what the electric field is just inside of that. And we could make a little Gaussian surface that encloses some charge. And if you do the math, the charge density has to equal the electric field outside of the surface minus, because of course the normal for the pillbox is pointing in the opposite direction, minus the electric field on the inside. And of course, the electric field is minus the derivative, so minus the electric field inside corresponds to the derivative of the inside solution, and the electric field on the outside corresponds to minus the derivative of that solution. Okay, so if I plug in what phi is and I take the derivative, what's going to happen is the n is going to come down and I'm going to have r to the n minus 1, and I'm going to evaluate that on the surface of the sphere where little r is capital R. When I take the derivative of this term, a minus n plus 1 is going to come down, and I'm going to get a r to the n plus 2 in the denominator. And when I evaluate this on the surface of the sphere, I'm going to have a capital r plus n2. So there's the n plus 1 that came from the derivative. The sign change came from the fact that these n's were in the denominator as opposed to the numerator. If we now apply this equation, we get this guy here. Okay, and that's kind of where we left off. Questions? Okay, so I hope it's clear. Fourier's trick is going to solve the problem for us, right? We can get what this expansion coefficient is if we dot both sides of the equation with one of our unit vectors. I'll call it a unit vector, even though it's not unit, with one of our PMs. And we can again get an expression for an in terms of things that we know. Right? So carrying out that process, I call that trash. Carrying out that process, what we're going to have then is on this side of the equation, if I multiply by Pm, I'm going to get the integral over from North Pole to South Pole of the charge density, which I claim I know, times Pm of cosine theta d cosine theta. That's going to equal what I get when I integrate out this sum. But all of these infinite number of terms are going to collapse to the single term where n happens to be the same value of m that I picked. So for that term, I'm going to get epsilon naught 2m plus 1 am times r to the m minus 1. And I'm going to have left over then the integral of this p with the p that I multiplied by d cosine theta. And that quantity is, of course, nicely 2 divided by 2m plus 1. So if I kind of finish this off, you can see that the 2m plus 1s are going to cancel. And I'm going to get 2 epsilon naught am r to the m minus 1. All of that has to equal this integral, which I can do, or have Mathematica do. So this represents then a formula for any of the expansion coefficients am. Okay. So we've worked the problem where the voltage is specified on the surface of the sphere. We've worked the problem where the charge density is specified on the surface of the sphere. They're not fundamentally different. Fourier's trick is what's going to give us the expansion coefficients. And of course, maybe it should be said, if I know what the A's are, I can use this equation to tell me what the C's are. So I've got then the solution inside and outside based on doing lots of these integrals. Okay. So that was example 2. So Take a look at your sheets for example three. So example three is kind of a special trick which crops up not uncommonly. And we have seen, you have done homework where you have calculated what the voltage or the electric field was on the z-axis, and it was pretty simple. Whereas if you had to calculate what the voltage or the electric field was not on the z-axis, it looked to be a mess. So in example three, we show how if you know the electric field on the z-axis, you can expand that to give you the voltage every place in space. Okay, so it's kind of a super trick. If you know the voltage at one spot, you can in fact calculate the voltage at every spot. Okay. So how does that trick work? Well, it's really easy to write down the steps, but it's going to be a little bit trickier to actually kind of see it in action. Right, so we're talking now about example three in the setup. And let's assume that I know what the voltage is on the z-axis. So I can, of course, apply Taylor's theorem and expand this and get this thing as some combination, some polynomial like that. And I also know, I don't know what the expansion coefficients are, but if I want to find out what the voltage is any place in space, and here let's assume that we're looking at an inside solution, just to be specific, then I know that we're going to have something of the form that is an r to the n times pn of cosine theta. Okay, so this has to be the case, but I just don't know these coefficients an. But of course, these two formulas have to give me the same value when I am on the z-axis. So if I plug into this formula that theta is equal to 0, and that's of course meaning that c is equal to 1, and remember that pn of 1 is always equal to 1, and on the z-axis r is equal to z, what this all amounts to then is just z to the n. So that means the only way these two formulas could agree is if capital AN equaled lowercase an. So if I can find the Taylor series expansion for my function on the z-axis, I can immediately apply those coefficients to tell me what the voltage is every place else. That's for all n, right? So the only way these things would all agree is if every coefficient of zn is the same for this equation and for that equation, right? Believe that?
I believe how you got there. I don't believe that it keeps applying. So for n equals 2, you have cosine theta for p.
Yeah, so for any pn, pn evaluated on the z-axis is equal to 1. That's a general properties of these p's. So you might remember, for example, that p2 was equal to 3/2 c squared minus 1/2. And if you put in c equals 1, you get 1. And p1 was equal to just c, and if I put in 1, I get 1. So it's a general property, it's not too hard to prove, that pn of 1 is equal to 1. And incidentally, of course, since these things are odd, or even according to the value of n, this means that pn of minus 1 is equal to minus 1 to the n. Okay, so I don't know. So let's kind of see this thing in action. So one problem that I think we've worked is the problem of a charged ring. So I have a charge that has radius r, some total charge q, and I want to find out what the voltage is every place. At least let's start with every place for small r, which is going to be every place inside a sphere, kind of like that. Why is that the boundary of the sphere? Well, because remember that we're solving Laplace's equation, and Laplace's equation says there's no charge. So we can't extend any solution past where there's charge. So here's where the charge is. There's going to be a different solution beyond that charge than there is inside that charge. Okay, well, it's pretty easy, right? Because this every spot z has the same distance from all of that charge. So phi as a function of z just has to be the total charge of that ring divided by 4 pi epsilon naught and our distance from that ring, which is just z squared plus r squared. Okay, so that's what z, that's what the voltage is as a function of z on the z-axis. What's the Taylor series expansion of this? Well, I don't know. Taylor series expansions maybe look to be a mess. Remember that we're looking for small z, so it's nice to kind of expand this thing so that the small z nature of it is more obvious. So if I pull out a capital R, this is going to be the square root of 1 plus z squared over r squared. And now remember the general formula, which I claim you can usefully tattoo on your bodies. 1 minus x to the minus alpha is equal to the sum of the shifted factorial, n factorial, times n to the x. So what we have here is 1 plus z squared over r squared to the minus a half. So this is going to be 1 half sub n, n factorial, and then minus z squared over r squared to the n. You can just tell me to rearrange it. So I've forgotten all of this stuff, right? I was just dealing with this thing by itself. Oh. Yes, sure looks like I dropped the R. Okay, so if we bring back all of that stuff, what we've got then is phi of z is equal to q over 4 pi epsilon naught r, and then we've got the sum of 1 half sub n over n factorial minus z squared over r squared to the nth power. And we know that this all has to equal a n z to the n. So this little thing here?
No, up one more.
That?
No, to the left.
Alpha.
No, it's alpha sub n. Well, that's alpha.
That's an alpha. So you can see that alpha is equal to 1 half, so I plugged in a half for that alpha, for my shifted factorial. And we can just kind of immediately pick off the terms. So first thing notice is there are no odd terms, right? So apparently a for odd is equal to 0. Right, we only have z to the 2n. So apparently, a sub 2n is equal to q divided by 4 pi epsilon naught r, 1 half sub n divided by n factorial, and then there's this minus sign, minus to the n over 2 divided by r to the 2n. Well, okay, I switched gears, right? So, yeah, what a mess. Oh. Yeah, so this just wants to be n. Okay? And, you know, then we're kind of good for gold. If you look at the plot, so that's this one here. So I put all that stuff into Mathematica, and I looked at what the voltage is. One of the things that's kind of cute is, what did Mathematica know about? Well, it only knew the voltage along this z-axis, and of course that's just going smoothly to zero. But Mathematica notices that there's a charge over here. You can see those half circles that must be surrounding something. They're surrounding the ring that is in the mathematics, even though this function phi of z just seems to be a smoothly varying function. So Mathematica has figured out that there has to be charge there just based on the behavior of the function on the z-axis. So this is what the solution is inside the ring. If we wanted the solution outside the ring, it would look pretty much the same, right? We'd just be instead of using positive powers, we'd be using inverse powers. A little bit louder?
How do we know that the A odd ones are zero?
Because they're no odd, they're no odd, there's no z to any odd power here. They're only z to even powers. So the coefficient of z odd would tell us what the corresponding A odd is. And zero is the coefficient of all the z to the odds, so all the A odds have to be zero. Yes.
Or like in all of them, what's the difference between one half sub 2 versus one half sub?
So that's the shifted factorial. So one half sub 3, that is one half times 3/2 times 5/2. So in general, what one half sub n is its terms that start with one half. And then we add one to each one. And what we have in the end is n terms. So it's kind of like the factorial. 1 sub n, that would start at 1 and it would go up to n, because we'd add 1 every time. So 1 sub n is exactly equal to n factorial. Okay, so shifted factorial, instead of starting at 1, it's starting at someplace else. Okay, that trick is done. So it's a pretty useful trick for finding potentials from just based on what's going on the z-axis. So there's one other standard problem that's in the book, and maybe now is as good a time to talk about it as any other. And what we have here is a conducting sphere. So this is made out of copper. And we put this sphere in what was before a uniform electric field. Right? So the electric field kind of looks like that. We put this piece of copper in it, and you know what's going to happen, right? The positive charge is going to migrate to this end of the copper, and the negative charge is going to migrate to that end of the copper, and it's going to change the nature of the electric field, particularly when we're close to the piece of copper. So how do we solve this problem? So what, of course, has to be the case is the voltage has to be constant on any piece of conductor. So the voltage has to be constant on the surface radius capital R of this conductor. Now, one of the things that is a little bit tricky about this example is I've said lots of times, and I do want you to have the knee-jerk reaction, that if we're outside, we're not going to have any terms like this. Okay, that's the right knee-jerk reaction. This is the exception. Because if we're going to have an electric field that is going to go to infinity, we need to have a voltage that is minus E naught times Z, right? So that when I take the gradient of that, I get E naught times K hat. So in this particular problem, the voltage can't be zero at infinity if there's an electric field, so I will have this sort of term. Well, what is this term? Well, z is, of course, equal to r times cosine theta. And cosine theta is P1. So this is equal to RP1. So that's exactly an A1 sort of term. So I claim then that my voltage outside of the sphere is equal to the sort of thing it could always have, namely the Cn over R to the n plus 1 times Pn. But I need to have, in addition to that, something that's going to make an electric field at infinity. Okay? I'm adding that on so that I have an electric field that's in the z direction infinitely far away. Of course, this voltage isn't going to produce a big electric field at infinity because it's at r equals infinity, it's going to go to zero. Right? So whatever electric fields this thing makes, they're going to be confined. They're not going to be big at r equals infinity. This is what's going to make the electric field at infinity. Okay.
This is
the setup of the problem. So typically, when we're outside a sphere like this, we only have terms like this. But because I told you that there was an electric field that was constant at infinity, I have to have this term, so I put it in. I'm not going to put it in any other terms because they would make electric fields that got bigger at infinity, right? They'd be r squared, r cubed, etc. So I call it quits at this first term. If I wanted to, I could add a constant, of course, but why bother, right? Constants don't make electric fields. That would be the n equals zero term from this piece.
Wouldn't that still go to infinity at infinity?
It would give you a constant voltage at infinity, but it wouldn't make an electric field at infinity. So usually we don't want to have constant electric fields at infinity either, but if we're going to have an infinite value at infinity, whether you add a constant to it or not, it's not going to be a big deal. So the green is the copper Cu sphere that is put in the uniform electric field. Okay, so what I do is I take my formula and I ask, what is the voltage on the surface of the sphere at any old angle? And of course, what I'm going to get is all of these infinite numbers of terms. And I'm also going to get this minus E naught R P1. And I know that this voltage has to be a constant. It can't actually depend on angle. So there are kind of lots of ways of proceeding from here. Maybe the most formal way of proceeding would be to recognize that I could calculate. So let's deal with n bigger than 1. So I'm not worried about these terms. But if I, and let me give this constant, well, I'm just going to call it a constant, I guess. So if I multiply both sides by Pm, I'm going to get the integral of whatever that constant voltage is times Pm dc. That's going to equal what I get from this side, which is going to be Cm divided by r to the m plus 1 times 2 over 2m plus 1. And as I say, this is maybe more formal than's necessary. I hope it's clear that that's zero. One way you can see that that's zero is that any constant can be written as P0, so that's P0 overlapping with Pm. Okay, so all of the terms for n greater than 1 are going to be zero. So the only terms we're going to have for our potential are going to be terms that are proportional to P1. So what I'm going to have is C1 divided by R squared minus E0R, all of that times P1. I repeat, if you really wanted to, you could add a constant, but I'm not going to do that. Okay. So if I have a grounded sphere, then that means that the voltage has to be zero on the surface of that sphere. So that means that C1 over R squared has to equal E naught times R, or that C1 has to equal E naught times R cubed. If the sphere isn't at 0 volts, then I can just bring back my constant and add any constant I want to this solution. Okay. So let me comment on one of the homework problems. One of the homework problems is going to be the same thing except in cylindrical coordinates. So we're going to have an infinite rod of copper that's going out of the page, and there's going to be a constant electric field in the x direction this time. No, this is homework is due next time. This is, I think, 312. And so here we're going to have a voltage that is going to be minus E naught times x, and so that's going to be minus E naught times R cosine phi, where phi is the cylindrical phi as opposed to anything else, which incidentally the book calls theta, and I will probably switch between calling theta and phi. Okay, so you're going to want to work this problem, but roughly speaking, the same sort of thing is going to happen. We're going to get charge separation and all of that sort of good stuff. Okay, so return to this section when you're in the book when you want to work that problem. Okay, but we haven't done anything with cylindrical coordinates yet. So the name of the game has been to solve Laplace's equation. And we've done it in rectangular coordinates, we've done it in spherical coordinates. Now the time comes to do it in cylindrical coordinates. So what's the equation for the Laplacian in cylindrical coordinates? So it's 1 over r derivative with respect to r of r derivative with respect to r of phi plus 1 over r squared 2 derivative, I guess that's why they use theta. Okay, we'll use theta. For this instant. Usually the phis don't last very long because we're dealing with things that are azimuthally symmetric, but this one is going to last for a while, so probably is smart to do it. And finally, two derivatives of z. Okay, so what we're going to deal with is an infinite cylinder, so we're dealing with no x dependence. Excuse me, no z dependence.
So that's a theta, that's a
phi. Say again?
Where you scribble that, that's a theta.
Yeah, so you understand the problem, right? Everyone uses phi for voltage. And they also use phi for the azimuthal angle in spherical coordinates. And since the azimuthal angle in spherical coordinates is exactly the same as what it is in cylindrical coordinates, I like to use phi for that too. In spherical coordinates, mostly we're not going to care about phi because we're going to have azimuthal symmetry. But we are going to work these angular problems in cylindrical coordinates. So we are going to want to have that angle, right? So in cross section, here's the x-axis, here's the angle theta now that I'm talking about. Z, of course, would be up, and the radial distance I'm denoting by r, right? So we still have the problem with r means something different in cylindrical coordinates than it does in spherical coordinates. That's life. Say again? This was the x-axis. Theta is measured from the x-axis. Okay, so the trick was separation of variables, right? We say it seems unlikely, but but we're going to look at solutions that factor, where we have a function of theta and a function of r. And we're going to plug that in to this equation. And of course, the r derivatives are only going to pay attention to capital R, and the theta derivatives are only going to pay attention to capital theta, and there's no z dependent, so that's going to go away. So what we're going to have then is theta is going to come out of this term, and then we're going to have 1 over the derivative of r times the derivative of r. And here, we're going to have, the r is going to come out for the ride, r squared times two derivatives with respect to theta. So we're going to do kind of the usual, put all of the theta stuff on one side of the equation, all the r stuff on the other side of the equation. So here I'm going to get r from this r squared canceling one of those. I'm going to divide it all by r, and that has to be minus theta double prime divided by theta. This depends on theta, this depends on r. The only possibility is it doesn't depend on either of them. It's the only way it could depend on both. So this is going to be some constant, which, with malice aforethought, I'm going to call m squared. This differential equation is one that you know and love already. So capital theta is going to be a linear combination of sine of m theta or cosine of m theta. For the other equation, we could solve it. There's a change of variable. So this is currently a second order non-constant coefficient differential equation. And we could make a change of variables and turn that into a constant coefficient second order differential equation. And those are things I'm sure they taught you how to solve. But we're going to take the easy way out, which is to say guess a solution and see that it works. So let me try a power. And a power is, so let me write down also the equation before I go too far. So this is r prime prime is equal to m squared capital R. A power law like this has a chance because I'm taking two derivatives, but I'm building back up the power by multiplying by r. So the derivatives are going to knock down the power of r by 2, and these factors are going to bring back the powers of r. So I'm going to end up with the same power on this side as I have on that side. So there's hope for something like this working. Okay, so the r prime is of course going to equal to a r to the a minus 1. R times that is going to equal a r to the a. And if I take the derivative of that, I just bring down another a. And then I multiply by r. And so what I've got here is a squared r to the a. And what I have here is m squared r to the a. And so there are two solutions, right? A can equal plus or minus m. I don't know. Okay, so the general solution then. So the general solution then is going to be add up. We can have questions. We can have some a little bit lower. And just a linear combination of everything. And we have Fourier's trick still working for us because cosine and sine are orthogonal functions. Right? So if I integrate between 0 and 2 pi, cosine of m theta times cosine of n theta, what I'm going to get is usually 0 unless m equals n. And in the other circumstance, the average value of cosine is a half, so I'm going to get pi. And it works the same way for sine, works the same way for cosine, etc. Okay. Now there's something that's a little bit awkward about this formula, and that is to say that all of these things aren't independent. Right? So I could take both these capital A terms and multiply them by 5, and I could divide these terms by 5, and I'd get exactly the same function. So it's a little bit awkward to have that sort of freedom. And usually it's not going to matter because we will usually have some sort of symmetry that's going to say that you only have the cosine terms or you only have the sine terms. So for example, in the homework problem, where we have an electric field that's pointing this way, what sort of functions are going to be possible? Because this way has to be exactly the same as that way, right? So it has to be even in theta, which means we're only going to have cosine sort of solutions. Okay, so here's a general form. You have to be a little bit wary because, in fact, they're not all independent. But the alternative is not happy. That's really the only way you can write it out that is at all a compact form. And of course, also I should comment that the usual thing are going to apply. This sort of term is what we're going to have when we're inside a cylinder. This is what we're going to have when we're outside the cylinder. Or said more compactly, otherwise being equal, if the potential at infinity isn't going to infinity, we can't have terms like that if the region of interest includes infinity. If the region of interest includes the origin, we can't have terms like that. You can imagine problems like where you have a couple of coaxial cylinders and you're interested in the voltage between them, then you might have both of those sorts of terms. But typically, you're either going to have one term or the other sort of term. Okay, so that's kind of it for Fourier's trick. Questions on Fourier's trick? We've done it in all of the coordinate systems, use separation of variables. Everything is okay, I hope. Any questions?
So Margaret? When you have the summation, are you saying pi by the actual?
Yeah, I just couldn't fit that term in after it. So I can really have an arbitrary linear combination of any of these four terms if you multiply them out. And that's a general solution. Might be worth reminding you that I said that there was another solution besides the PN for the angles, but that it was singular. It went to infinity, so we didn't have to have it. So that's why there are two here, but there was only one when we had the spherical coordinates. Okay, so this is a real important trick in order to calculate voltages. And so we have an option here, and I think I'll probably decide for myself unless you convince me otherwise. So one thing we could do at this point is solve the angular differential equation using the stuff that you learned in DiffEQ. And I think that you don't want to do that. That's just going to look like a lot of algebra. So what I'd like to do instead, I think, I don't hear any great objections, is to go on to a really funny method which is not as powerful as this Fourier method. So these Fourier methods really do basically answer all questions. You can get rid of the requirement of azimuthal symmetry. You can get rid of the requirement that it doesn't depend on z. It just makes the equations a little bit messier and introduces functions that you're probably not familiar with, like Bessel functions. But it all works. So what we're going to talk about now is a real special case that is weird, but that answers lots of interesting answers, a half dozen interesting cases that really occur. And this is the method of images.
Fin.
Say again?
Fin.
Done.
Oh.
We're done with Fourier's trick. So, way back in 370, we had the problem of a electron that had been ejected from a big piece of copper. Actually, it was tungsten. And we said that there was a force that was pulling it back. And we can kind of see what that force is going to be, right? Because we know that this minus charge is going to attract positive charges along this boundary. We know there's no charge density here, right? Because inside of a conductor, there's no charge density. But there could be surface charge, and it'll be a positive surface charge. And then there'll be these forces that are pulling this electron back. And remember, we talked about the escape velocity was necessary to get out of this piece of metal and all of those sorts of things. So this looks to be a hard problem, right? How do I figure out what this force is that's pulling an electron back to some piece of metal? And the trick is that all we really have to do is to satisfy Laplace's equation, at least where there's no charge, and satisfy the boundary conditions. So if I can think of, by some sort of magic, some solution that satisfies Laplace's equation and satisfies the boundary condition, it has to be the solution. Right? These solutions are unique. So it doesn't matter how I come up with it, as long as I can think up of one that works, it'll be good. So, what are the boundary conditions? Well, the boundary conditions, of course, is that the voltage at infinity better be zero, and this is grounded, so the voltage on this boundary and anything over there better be zero. So, of course, the electron just sitting here by itself, it's going to make a voltage that is going to be its charge divided by 4 pi epsilon naught, and then its distance, the distance from that charge. How can I find something else that's going to make the voltage be zero all along this boundary? And the answer is, If I think about a positive charge that is exactly symmetrically located with respect to that electron, this guy by itself would make a voltage that is equal to its charge divided by 4 pi epsilon naught and its distance from it. So if I ask about what the voltage is at a spot here, it's exactly the same distance from both of those charges. So we're going to have the same r, we have opposite numerators, so it's going to add up to zero. And it's going to add up to zero no matter where I am at that boundary if this positive charge is exactly a mirror position of the other charge, right? And in particular, of course, the same distance from the boundary as the electron was. So I claim then that the voltage on the right-hand side is given by the voltage that I would have from the electron plus the voltage I would get from this mythical charged particle that doesn't exist inside the piece of copper.
That's just
Say again?
That's probably interesting.
Yeah, so I mirror the position and the charge. So the mirror of minus is positive. Okay, so this is the solution for what the voltage is on the right-hand side. Of course, the voltage on the left-hand side is zero every place because we're inside of that conductor. So I only use this image charge where it's not part of the area of concern, because it doesn't actually exist. Okay? So I've satisfied Laplace's equation. I've satisfied the boundary conditions. This has to be the solution. And it's very easy then to calculate what the force is, right? Because the force is just the force that you would have between those two particles, one of which is mythical, right? So there would end up being an attractive force that would be the product of the charges divided by 4 pi epsilon naught and the distance between them, which is 2d squared. Okay, so there's a strong attractive force, particularly when the electron is close to the conductor, that's going to bring the electron back. And just as with rockets, if you throw them up fast enough, they can escape. Same thing with this electron. If you throw it out fast enough, it'll have enough kinetic energy to overcome this force and escape to infinity. Okay, so, I mean, this is a trick, right? How far can we extend this trick to other sorts of problems? So let's think about trying to do the same thing with a sphere. Right? So a not uncommon problem. So here I'm going to have a grounded conducting sphere, and I'm going to have a charged particle, which I'm just going to call Q, that's outside of the sphere. Can I come up with some mythical charges that match the boundary conditions? And the boundary conditions, of course, are that pens disappear. The boundary conditions, of course, is I want to solve Laplace every place that it's correct. And I want to have the boundary conditions satisfied of the voltage. And the boundary conditions are, of course, that the voltage on the surface of the sphere is zero, and the voltage at infinity is also zero. So can I find something that's going to work? And if we just kind of follow our guts, what we would guess is we're going to want to put some charge, say Q prime, that is inside the sphere, and hopefully make it be able to work. Okay, so I'm going to put this mythical charge Q prime at a location that I'm going to call R prime. And I'm going to try and see if I can make the voltage be zero on the surface of this sphere. So here's the center of the sphere. R prime is, of course, being measured from that point. And the charge Q is at a spot that is just R. And the radius of the sphere is capital R. Okay, so what is the voltage at an arbitrary spot? Right? So if I ask for the voltage at that spot, what of course I need is the distance to these charges. I just need to add them up. And we could go through this process again, but maybe we can kind of short circuit it. If I have a triangle, like I do, so this is a triangle that has some side that is, notation is killing me. I need another R. I guess it's script R.
What is that?
That's the same thing as this thing here. I'm asking what the voltage is some distance from the center of the sphere that is script R. Mm-hmm. Cursive R. And I have Q here that is at some distance R, and I have Q prime that is at some distance R prime. So this distance here, if this is the angle theta, we've talked about this before. You can go through the process. We've done it before. But the law of cosine is actually pretty helpful. This is going to be 1 over kind of what Pythagoras would say, script R squared plus R squared, and then minus 2 script R R cosine theta. And the same thing is going to give us for this distance from Q prime, except there it's going to be R prime. Okay, so if I work that all up, the voltage at some spot script R theta is going to be 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught, might as well go along for the ride, and then I'm going to have Q divided by this stuff, square root of script R squared plus R squared minus 2 script R R cosine theta, and then plus Q prime divided by square root of script R squared plus R prime squared minus 2 script R R prime cosine theta. Okay, so I haven't made this work yet, but if there are physically these two charges, then this would be the corresponding voltage at any spot you name. Now what I want is I want this voltage on the surface of the sphere for any angle theta to be zero. So that means that this term has to cancel that term. So let's see what that's going to say. So we have to have then that Q divided by the square root of R squared plus R squared minus 2 R R, and I'll use C for cosine theta, that has to be minus Q prime divided by square root of R squared plus R prime squared minus 2 R R prime cosine theta. So that has to be true for all cosine theta. So the question is, can I pick a Q prime and an R prime where no matter what cosine I choose, I in fact get these things to be the same? I don't know, is there any sort of hope? But I can't, right? So R prime is where this mythical charge is, and it better be inside the conductor, right? It can't be in physical space because we know what's really there. So the only place we can hide the image charge is in a block of copper.
But right on the sphere, wouldn't the limits be getting really close to each other? Because it's going to be just
Well, so what should be the case, and I think you're 100% right, is if this R, so if the location of the physical charge was basically the sphere plus a little bit, then it's the sphere is going to look like an infinite plane then, right? If you're really close, like the Earth, people thought it was flat, right, even though it's a sphere. So it must be that R prime is going to have to be something like that, and Q prime is going to have to be kind of like minus Q. So something like this has to be the case for small delta. But it doesn't work in general. It's not good enough. One of the ways you can see that it's not good enough is if I make lowercase r more than 2r away, I can't have Q prime leave the surface of the sphere, right? It can't push out that side. So something like this has to be the case for small delta, but it can't be the case always. So So I don't see any hope, right? But obviously there has to be hope. So that means more algebra, right? So what I'm going to suggest is for both sides, let's pull out the big thing. Let's pull the big thing out of the radical. So for this one here, the big thing is lowercase r, right? Because it's outside the sphere. And for this one here, the big thing is capital R, because r prime is inside the sphere. So I don't know, maybe. Yeah, the longest length. I'm going to pull that out of the radical and see if anything useful happens. You're right. Thank you. Saved by the bell. Okay, so then we're going to have here Q, and this time I'm going to try and pull out the big one. So this is going to be R squared over R squared plus 1 minus 2 R over R cosine theta. I might drop my cosine theta. Say again? Oh, yes. Well, if these things are going to match, what has to be the case? Well, the coefficient of C has to be the same, right? So it better be that R prime over R equals R over R. And if I do that, this side also works, right? So, I don't know, so far so good. If I make Q prime equal to R divided by RQ, then I can make the rest of it work. Yeah, so my image charge is going to vary with my displacement. But notice that if this thing is a little bit more than the radius of the sphere, then pretty much this is going to be the opposite of Q. When R gets big, this guy is going to do what? It's going to go to the center, and it's going to have a very small charge, which I think kind of makes sense. I think it's clear that it always wanted to be on this side of the center. So, I don't know, this works, right? So, you know, kind of an old-fashioned problem which we talked about in 200 but we didn't actually solve. If we have a grounded conducting sphere and we put a charged particle next to it, we know that there's going to be an attractive force. What's the magnitude of that force? Well, we can do that now because we know that the problem is equivalent to having an image charge here that's at a location that is equal to r over lowercase r.
So they just have to be on the same plane?
Yeah, so it's line. So it's not only on the same plane, it's on the same line. So there's going to be the distance between these two guys, if you work it out, is going to be r minus capital R squared divided by r. And so the force is going to be Q times Q prime, let's just use the Coulomb constant to be different, divided by this distance squared. And we know the value of Q prime is given by that formula there. So I don't know, continuing here, I'm going to have an attractive force, K Q squared, and then R over R, and then all of this stuff.
Did you say that the question was, what's it on that, at that point, right, off of the sphere?
Yeah, so the question I was asking and answering was, what is the attractive force that this guy feels when it's next to a conducting sphere that's grounded? Okay, so this is another neat solution that's not an uncommon problem that we've solved. How about if it's not grounded, how about if it's uncharged? So these words sound alike, but remember that they're different, right? Grounded means that the voltage is equal to zero. Uncharged means that there's no net charge. So what I have is a solution in which the sphere encloses some charge. And so it corresponds to a problem where the negative charge has, where the positive charge has gone running down the wire that was connected to ground, and I now have a net charge on that sphere. So that was the grounded case. In the net charge case, if there are three negative charges on that side, there's a balancing three charges on that side, and we want to find that physical solution. Well, so is there any way I can still use the same sort of setup, but the boundary condition has now changed a little bit, right? The boundary condition isn't that the voltage is zero here. It could be any old constant. But I want to have the sphere to enclose zero net charge. And if you think about it, what's going to work is the following. So I put my Q prime at its appropriate place. And at the origin, I put minus Q prime. So now there's no net charge. By putting a charge at the origin, I don't change the fact that the voltage is a constant on this sphere. So I still satisfy that boundary condition. Okay, so this guy and the outside charge Q made the voltage be zero on the boundary. This guy in the center makes the voltage be some other constant. Okay, so we got a handful of these special cases which are useful, physically useful special cases that allow us to figure out what the voltage is in all space without doing infinite sums and that sort of stuff. So, I don't know, half a dozen useful cases. Fourier method always works, but it's not trivial. Okay, questions? Looks like 12:30 if the